From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Just 100 days into his second term, at his press conference Tuesday, President Obama had to make the case that he hasn't already run out of juice. That's not fun for any president. And what is the juice, anyway? Is it the bully in the bully pulpit, the arm twister, the schmoozer, the reasoned leader? What's it take to move the nation, to lead? This hour On Point, President Obama, leadership, and the juice question. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Does the president have the juice, the fight, the fire to get his agenda through? What about the votes? How should Obama lead? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Over the weekend, it was kind of funny. At the White House Correspondents' Dinner on Saturday, President Obama talked about advice he got from his advisors on that night's speech.
They suggested that I should start with some jokes at my own expense, just to take myself down a peg. I was like, guys, after 4.5 years, how many pegs are there left?
And there were more laughs about the lonely president.
I know Republicans are still sorting out what happened in 2012, but one thing they all agree on is they need to do a better job reaching out to minorities. And look, call me self-centered. But I can think of one minority they could start with. Hello.
And then came the Tuesday press conference, marking the first 100 days of President Obama's second term. ABC News' Jonathan Carl asked the president a provocative question.
Mr. President, you are 100 days into your second term. On the gun bill, you put seems everything into it to try to get it passed. Obviously, it didn't. Congress has ignored your efforts to try to get them to undo these sequester cuts. There was even a bill that you threatened to veto that got 92 Democrats in the House voting yes. So my question to you is, do you still have the juice to get the rest of your agenda through this Congress?
Well, if you put it that way, Jonathan, maybe I should just pack up and go home. Golly. I think as Mark Twain said, rumors of my demise may be a little exaggerated.
Not exactly a roaring comeback. Let's dive in here. With us today from New Haven, Connecticut, is Beverly Gage, professor of history at Yale University, U.S. history from the Gilded Age to the 20th century. She's thought a lot about U.S. presidents, including this one. Beverly Gage, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us, On Point News Analyst. Great to have you, Jack. Hello, and thanks for joining us today.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Beverly.
Okay, Jack, let me come first to you. What do you make of this moment and this president being asked, have you got the juice? He's only 100 days into his second term.
Well, you know, I think many people felt with 90% public approval for background checks, the president should have been able to get the gun bill, the gun control bill passed. It was the margin. It seemed almost unanimous. And yet, when you look at what participants in that debate have said, their postmortems, presidential persuasion or leadership doesn't seem to come first. Joe Manchin, for example, the West Virginia senator, the co-sponsor of the bill, he said, if we had gone to a bill like this immediately after Newtown, when Newtown was, you know, the public consciousness was full of the horror, he said, boom, we could have done something. So that was a question of timing. If the president had Congress was in session, the Senate was in January, he could have given him a bill there. Manchin says that was a failure. Joe Biden, what does he think? Well, talking to analysts this week, gun control people, he said that the GOP senators had to choose between tough votes on immigration and guns. It was one or the other. They chose to vote against guns. And finally, Pat Toomey, the co-sponsor, the Republican co-sponsor of the bill, said just yesterday, he said, there were some on my side who did not want to be seen helping the president on something just because he wanted to do it. In other words, polarization, partisanship, we can't give the president what he wanted. So those are three participants who fault the president, perhaps for timing, but also point to these structural impediments.
Beverly Gage, give us some big historical perspective on this president and this moment. Here he is with a whole second term in front of him, minus 100, now 100 and change days. And he has the press asking him, do you still have the juice, which is a pretty fundamental question. You know, do you still have the fire in your belly to do this job, to push your agenda through? Is that weird? Is that unprecedented? Is that what everybody runs into somehow in their second term? What did you make of it, Beverly?
I think it's a little unprecedented in the kind of flip way in which it was asked, but that may just be a product of our age. I'm not sure.
Our Twitter era.
Exactly. Yeah. But unfortunately, the track record for second terms is not terrific. Most people don't have second terms that outweigh their first terms, certainly. And in fact, all of the great periods of legislative achievement that we tend to think about, they tend to be in the president's first couple of years. So I think the crises that Obama is facing, or this question of where the juice is going to come from, or what's the agenda, or is he already a lame duck, those aren't unusual questions, though I think the particular question was a little unusual.
I wonder about this president's approach. Let's listen here. And this is something we've heard again and again, and I wonder how it's working or not working, how it compares with past presidents. The president appealing to reason and saying that, look, you know, I'm putting forward reasonable solutions up on Capitol Hill. Congress has to think about these things. They have to think and they have to act responsibly. That's their job. Here he is again interacting with ABC's Jonathan Carl at that Tuesday press conference.
Jonathan, you seem to suggest that somehow these folks over there have no responsibilities and that my job is to somehow get them to behave. That's their job. They are elected, members of Congress are elected, in order to do what's right for their constituencies and for the American people.
That's their job. Beverly Gage, stand by, and Jack Beatty. George Edwards joins us now as well. George Edwards of Texas A&M at Oxford, author of On Deaf Ears, The Limits of the Bully Pulpit, and The Strategic President, Persuasion and Opportunity in Presidential Leadership. He also wrote Overreach, Leadership in the Obama Presidency. He joins us today from Oxford, England. George Edwards, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be here.
What do you make of the president's, this is not the first time we've heard it, but President Obama looks up to Capitol Hill, says, look, I put forward reasonable suggestions. We clearly have needs to act in this country, and that's their job. That's the job of Congress. So don't expect me to run around the flagpole and bully pulpit all day and all night. That's their job. It's only reasonable for them to do it. What about that as a manner of presidential leadership, George?
Well, that doesn't reflect much leadership, but I think what it also reflects is the frustration and the president's inability to move the public and to move members of Congress. This is quite typical in American history. All presidents face this problem. And so I think that it's just the frustration is coming out when he's saying, well, look, the problem is not with me. There's only so much I can do. And you've actually seen the president speaking in almost those terms at other times in the last couple of weeks.
So when, let's say, Maureen Dowd comes out in the New York Times and says, hey, there's no bully in the bully pulpit, like there's nobody home in the White House. Is that fair, George?
No, it's not fair. I view that as much more of a rant than as a useful analysis. The fact is we have very good data going back actually to Franklin Roosevelt, and we know that presidents very rarely can move the public in their direction, particularly if there's an organized opposition. And presidents of all qualities, of all political stripes, fail systematically. And we can take examples of great communicators like Ronald Reagan, and he could not move the public. He couldn't move the public on defense policy. He couldn't move the public on Iran-Contra. To just take two examples of high priority items for him. And then we can think of Bill Clinton, another great politician. And he comes in, and the first priority was on the economy. He couldn't move the public on the economy. He couldn't get what he wanted. He wanted a stimulus bill, which by modern terms is very tiny. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, if you recall, the election of 1992 was ostensibly about the economy. He got nowhere. And then health care reform, which he said was the cornerstone of his administration. And it started out pretty well, and then the more the opposition got organized and the more it articulated its point of view, of course, it died, didn't come to a vote in either house of Congress. So the great explainer is he's frequently known these days, and is a very talented politician, simply could not move the public. So it's not surprising at all that Barack Obama faces the same problems.
And yet, George, some presidents do come to be seen as accomplished, impactful leaders. What is Barack Obama up against here?
Well, I think it depends on what I call the opportunity structure. When presidents have been successful, there's usually an opportunity that they could exploit. And the smart ones, the good leaders, exploit those opportunities effectively, whether it's Lyndon Johnson exploiting very large majorities in 1965 and 1966 to get through the Great Society or the Great Society legislation, which includes, of course, some civil rights bills, Medicare, aid to education, or Ronald Reagan in his first year in office when you had a country that was very concerned about economic problems, high inflation, high unemployment. And he offered them a tax cut and tried to control spending, which wasn't terribly successful. But at any rate, he was able to get through some major pieces of legislation by exploiting a small window. And he did. He was very effective at it. Barack Obama doesn't have lots of opportunities right now, and that makes it very difficult for him.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Barack Obama and presidential leadership, the juice question, and whether or not he's got it. Beverly Gage is with us, professor of history at Yale University. George Edwards of Texas A&M at Oxford joins us. Jack Beatty is here. Sometimes it's a great big appeal to the public. Here's President Lyndon Johnson describing his vision for the Great Society at the University of Michigan on May 22, 1964, an idea that became in large part a reality.
Your imagination and your initiative and your indignation will determine whether we build a society where progress is the servant of our needs, or a society where old values and new visions are buried under unbridled growth. For in your time, we have the opportunity to move not only toward the rich society and the powerful society, but upward to the great society.
Sounds like the bully pulpit to me, complete with reverb and echo there. Here's our current President Obama Tuesday at his press conference, saying there's only so much he can do to make Congress act responsibly.
I cannot force Republicans to embrace those common sense solutions. I can urge them to. I can put pressure on them. I can, you know, rally the American people around those common sense solutions. But ultimately, they themselves are going to have to say, we want to do the right thing.
Beverly Gage in New Haven put those two side by side. There's LBJ. Now, to be fair, you know, he's at a great big setting, and you can hear the echoes and reverb throughout the whole arena there. And here's President Obama in kind of a difficult, low-key press conference. But one's got this grand call to action, and the other you can hear almost a shrug in the president's voice. How do you interpret those two, Beverly?
Well, I think it's true that if you put Obama's inauguration speech up there instead of his rather downbeat press conference a few days ago, that would be a different story. But I think Lyndon Johnson did, in fact, have a vision, but he also had a couple of things that Barack Obama doesn't have that tend to be the things that make it possible for a president to act well. And there are really three circumstances under which presidents tend to be able to get legislation passed. And this goes back to what George was saying about opportunity. So one is a moment of crisis. That can be a financial crisis. It can be a foreign affairs crisis. The second is a period of real legislative dominance in which certainly your own party, but also members of the other party, but your own party mainly, are going to cooperate with you. And the third is when there's some sort of mass movement that is really pushing you in a significant way. to do something about legislation, and you can kind of come in and champion that. Lyndon Johnson was very lucky because for most of his presidency, certainly in 64, and then once he was officially elected in 65 and 66, he had a lot of all of those things going on. And so it really wasn't per se speech making. Vision helps, but it also really helps to have a cooperative Congress and also to have really mass movements behind you and pushing for what it is that you want to do.
We'll look at that mass movement, where it might be. The president's talked about it. He talked about it in the campaign and keeping it rolling right on over into his second term, but here we are. Joe in Buffalo, New York. Joe, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think one of the problems with President Obama is he appears to be very conflict-averse, and I think he's incapable of getting angry. And sometimes, especially with the obstructionist Republicans, in my view, that are in running the House right now, sometimes you have to fight, and it takes a degree of anger and cajoling, like LBJ got civil rights through that way, and behind the scenes, Truman and presidents like that. Sometimes they really fought for the principles they believed in, and when the president extends the olive branch to the other side, they basically take it from him and beat him over the head with it time and time again. And I just think his conflict averse, as I said, and that really hurts his chances of getting his agenda through.
Joe, let us pick it up. George Edwards, how about it? This is a president who goes to reason very quickly. Joe sees him as conflict averse. I mean, but we saw him after the gun vote, the anger in the Rose Garden of that big speech there. Is this a president cut off by personality or circumstance from anger? Does anger, pounding the table, help when it comes to presidential leadership?
First of all, I don't think he's conflict averse. And second, anger doesn't really help very much. Lyndon Johnson, Beverly gave a very astute analysis, and Lyndon Johnson had people who were in Congress who were predisposed to vote for the policies he was proposing, and they weren't unpopular policies. Medicare was not unpopular in 1965. No was aid to education, and the great civil rights movement climaxed just when Lyndon Johnson needed it to climax. So we had the 64 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act, two monumental pieces of legislation. But as Beverly said, he had great, great opportunities then, and he exploited them effectively. What good would it do for Barack Obama to go and yell at the Republicans in the House of Representatives? I don't think it'd do very much at all for him, and they have no reason to respond. In fact, their constituents don't want him to respond. They want him to do something else. In fact, you'll notice that when Barack Obama was going to propose his own immigration plan in Las Vegas back at the end of February, the senator from New York, Chuck Schumer, called him and said, please don't. Because if you're associated with the plan, it makes it more difficult for the Republicans to actually negotiate with us. So it's better to stay back, not get your fate in their face, but stay back and let us develop a plan which you will then support as best you can.
And we'll see what happens. Jack, is it a matter of expectations? People want a fighting president out there, at least those in his corner. I mean, after his angry Rose Garden speech on the failure of the gun legislation, there were people who said, well, why didn't he give that angry speech before the vote? Would it have made a difference, though, to George's point, Jack?
I just don't think so. I mean, the governing reality for Republicans is that primary threat from somebody to the right of an incumbent. And even in a situation where 80, 70, 90% of their constituents seem to favor something like universal background checks, that 10%, that very intense 10% is almost sure to vote. And when you look at what's happened in GOP primaries, Senator Bennett in Utah lost his seat at a state convention with just a few thousand people voting. In Richard Lugar's primary in Indiana, I think turnout barely made into double figures. And point is, a very small number of people can cost these incumbents their seats. They're aware of that. And they're not going to take any risks on the right. I mean, they don't have to worry about a challenge from a Democrat. It's the challenge from the primary.
But on the other hand, you have to do something. You can't just throw in the towel. Maybe he can't get angry. But in that White House Correspondents' Dinner, which of course is a setting for humor, we get it. But still, you know, this joke is one that Mitch McConnell will no doubt remember for a long time, the president discussing advice he got on reaching out to Republicans in Congress at the Correspondents' Dinner Saturday night.
Some folks still don't think I spend enough time with Congress. Why don't you get a drink with Mitch McConnell, they ask. Really? Why don't you get a drink with Mitch McConnell?
And, of course, now Mitch McConnell has his ad out where he's sitting at the bar with a beer and a glass of wine waiting for the president. I mean, Beverly, why don't you get a drink with Mitch McConnell? That sounds like you are never going to be talking with Mitch McConnell, Mr. President.
It does suggest that, and I don't think that actually drinking with Mitch McConnell is probably the solution to the country's ills. But I do think that there are actually things that Obama could be doing that he is not doing at the moment, and not so much in terms of twisting the Republicans' arms, trying to get them to cooperate with him, but in taking advantage of the people who actually want to cooperate with Obama and giving encouragement to these kind of movements that are outside policy movements, larger movements like the labor movement, around climate change. There are all sorts of things that he can do without Congress, both in terms of administrative policy, in terms of executive orders and the sorts of things that he can just do on his own, but also in terms of this thing that we're calling the bully pulpit. And I think in many ways, people have sort of the wrong idea about what the bully pulpit is, which is to say, I think we have an idea that the president's going to get up and he's going to give a big speech and he's going to preach fire and brimstone and everybody's going to – right, and everybody's going to come around and agree with him suddenly. And that's really not what the bully pulpit is. I mean, that's kind of how Teddy Roosevelt sometimes wanted to use it. But I think what the bully pulpit is and the ways in which it can be effective is that the president has enormous power to – encourage, to legitimize, and to kind of get all of the people who are out there who want to push for particular policies, get them mobilized. And I think that he has been trying to say that. That was one of the messages of his inaugural speech. And you've seen him saying, I mean, that in some ways is kind of the implication of why don't you have drinks with Mitch McConnell is, you know, if you want these things to happen, I need you to be mobilizing too. I need you to push me to do this. It's a very Franklin Roosevelt kind of approach. You want me to do this, get out there and force me to do it and force everybody else too.
So George, who are you going to call here? I mean, you quote Shakespeare from Henry IV. I guess JFK talked about this one too. Everybody knows the line where Glendower says, I can call spirits from the vasty deep, and Hotspur says, why, so can I or so can any man, but will they come when you do call them? What does President Obama call on at this point to muster? Is it all about the 2014 primaries? Is it organizations to bring out their troops on his behalf?
Well, there's no silver bullet to begin with, so we have to start with that. Beverly was talking about mobilizing those who already support you, and that is the best that you can do, but whether or not you can succeed in doing that is another question. Presidents rarely mobilize successfully. We saw it once with Ronald Reagan. There was a lot of calls came in after Reagan gave a speech about his economic plan back in the middle of 1981. He was never able to do it again, and no one's been able to do it since. So it doesn't mean it's impossible, but on gun control is a good example, where at least on one of the policies we had 90% support for the background checks, and you wonder, well, how can people ignore that? And I think it was Jack who was talking about the activists are on the other side. And the pro-gun people, I mean, they certainly the pro-gun control people certainly express their views, and they articulate them just fine. But do they mobilize when it counts? Do they mobilize in elections and make effective threats in a democracy, which is to withhold your votes? And are they distributed in a way that they can be effective against those who will not vote for gun control? It's very difficult. They have not been able to do that to this point.
I mean, maybe there's something in our current gerrymandered universe that makes that impossible. Maybe it's hard to find vulnerability on the other side once you've gerrymandered, you know, so completely. Or, we've got a listener online, George, Beverly Jack, saying, I think the whole dynamic of the bully pulpit has changed with the infusion of 24-hour news cycle. Congressmen, senators, pundits, they all take advantage. They have unlimited access to the public. They interpret the president. They've got as much pulpit time as he does. Marcus says, I don't think the bully pulpit works like it used to, Jack.
Well, it's a, you know, you could say that the bully pulpit, in fact, did work with the public. Go back to December, before Newtown. I don't know that background checks, I tried to find the data, but it was somewhere, you know, 40%, 35%, something. It wasn't very high public
support. People weren't thinking
support.
About it before
no.
Newtown.
No, but after Newtown, it wasn't just Newtown, it was the president. He made it a huge issue in speech after speech, in a poignant moment in his State of the Union address where he said, give a vote. Give us a vote for Gabby Giffords. Give us a vote for those children. Give us a vote. And, of course, he was just asking for the vote. He wasn't asking even for a victory. But the point is, he made it a salient issue with the public, but he couldn't convert it with enough senators. And you say, well, why? Well, you know, if Richard Neustadt is right and the power of the presidency is the power to persuade, the essence of it, he says, is bargaining. So what bargain could the president make, say, with the four Democrats who voted against it? I mean, yeah. Could he say, you know, I need this? Well, they're going to turn to him and say, Mr. President, we can't risk that. There's nothing here for us. We have to be in Alaska. I just can't make that vote. And he can't then say, well, it really is in your interest. Is it really? Very tough sell.
Is there nothing a president can hold over the heads of a senator from Alaska anymore? You would think there'd be something. Dan in Springfield, Illinois. Dan, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I love your show. I'm an Iraq veteran and a journalist, and I think Obama is using really poor decision-making. I don't know why he's focusing on guns at all with the economy the way it is, with the sequester still in effect. And I think America knows when it's being emotionally pandered to. You know, I'm more insulted than moved when I see him bring out Newtown and bring out the children, and especially when he's backing all of this up with really poor facts and self-education. So many politicians have said so many untrue things about the way firearms work and about the statistics. I dispute the 90% background checks myself, the support for that, and even if that is there, there are people that have been caught by the background checks that aren't being prosecuted by Obama's Justice Department.
So Dan, you think he's sort of going for cheap emotional levers here to manipulate the public. On the other hand, when these things happen, I don't know, Beverly, you talk about a moments of opportunity. Is that part of what constitutes presidential leadership, when events create an outlook or an attitude or even emotion, which Dan's not happy about in this case? Is that a moment for presidents to move on their agenda?
Often it is. A crisis was one of the things that I said really actually makes a big difference. And Jack mentioned early on that there were complaints that the timing was just off, that the emotional intensity of Newtown, which was in December, yeah. Had kind of faded somehow.
That he waited too long. Okay.
Right, right. And I think it is also true that what matters about public opinion is not opinion, right? Unfortunately, we would like to believe, and maybe Barack Obama does believe, but I don't think he really does, that everyone in government is supposed to be reasonable and that that's the way things work, and also that, you know, the laws that emerge reflect public opinion. We have 90% of the public supporting something, therefore it should become law. But of course, that's not really how it works, and what matters is not opinion per se, but organized opinion. And the fact is that there's just, on the gun issue, a whole lot more organizing on one side than on the other, and that the emotionally intense crisis of Newtown actually seems to have passed shockingly quickly.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Barack Obama and presidential leadership with George Edwards, distinguished professor of political science at Texas A&M, holds the chair in presidential studies at the Bush School of Government and Public Service, also professor of American Government at the University of Oxford. author of Overreach and the Strategic President and On Deaf Ears. You can read excerpts from those at our website, onpointradio.org. Beverly Gage joins us from New Haven, Connecticut today, professor of history at Yale University. Jack Beatty is with us, and you can join us. What do you think? Does this president have the juice 100 days into Obama's second term? What's the prospect? Does it boil down to needing a Democratic House? Is he lining up to get that or not? Of course, he's not the first president to find himself up against it, in trouble. Many, many, many have. Here's President Clinton in his State of the Union address 1994, threatened to veto any health care legislation short of universal health care. He never was able to get a bill passed.
If you send me legislation that does not guarantee every American private health insurance that can never be taken away, you will force me to take this pen, veto the legislation, and we'll come right back here and start all over again.
And a little more than a year later, it was President Clinton saying the president is relevant, insisting on the relevancy of the president. Let's go to our listeners, Laura in Boston. Thanks for calling, Laura. You're on.
Hi, Tom. I'm wondering what your guests think about Barack Obama's community organizing background. They've already touched on the movements, and I'm wondering if perhaps some people interpret his lack of juice as really his just worldview manifesting as far as the public being the movers and shakers.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I mean, we say lack of juice, and yet this is a president who's shown so much juice in many settings. But the community organizing background, where essentially you don't get out front, you want the community to take the bit in its teeth and run with it. Beverly Gage, could that experience somehow condition him to go, for his go-to mode to be, look, Congress, I've made a reasonable case, now it's your job, you do it?
I think it really might be just the opposite, actually. So Obama, okay, his community organizing, I think we've seen best on display in campaigns. And he is a fantastic campaigner, and he really knows how to build campaign organizations. But I think one of the big mistakes he made, even in his first term, even in 2009, 2010, when it seemed like he was actually getting at least some of the legislation that he wanted passed, was that he kind of dropped that ball once he got into the Oval Office. He surrounded himself by a relatively insular group of people who were sort of inclined toward technocratic solutions. And so I think there's been actually something of a disconnect between the campaign trail, where he really does know how to mobilize and where he does, and where speeches really do matter a lot, and what he's been doing once he's in office, which I think really has not been reaching out in many ways to the kinds of constituencies who would be inclined to step up and move forward with him. I think the most notable examples here are the labor movement, in which a lot of the very early kind of gestures and promises that he made to the labor movement have kind of been dropped and set by the wayside. And the other is the environmental movement and kind of all of the stuff about climate change. Climate change seems to stay third priority or so, and he doesn't have that kind of relationship with the larger movements, in my view.
How do you interpret that? Does that mean that in that case, the president thinks they don't have the juice or the votes?
I think that may be quite what it means. The really interesting counterexample now is Obama's turnaround on gay rights and on gay marriage in particular. And I don't think anyone would argue that he was a leader in this area. He was sort of amenable but conservative. Mm-hmm. And once he saw both that opinion had somehow changed and that the movement itself was really pretty well organized, was going to be quite an important Democratic constituency around which people could vote or would vote, he really began to change his tune. However, it is also worth noting that was a pretty low-cost gesture to make in the end, because we're not really talking about legislation, right? There's
right.
no legislative
right.
battle out there. So that really was a kind of bully pulpit gesture.
But George Edwards, what about the opposition that this president in particular is up against? Saturnine writes to us on Twitter, says, to be fair, the degree of current obstruction, he's saying, is unseen since Congress killed Reconstruction in the early 1870s. This is a kind of almost unparalleled level of opposition or obstruction.
That's correct. We have the highest level of polarization both in Congress and in public opinion in at least 100 years. So there's a greater difference between evaluations of Democrats and Republicans about President Obama than in any president for which we have data. There's a greater difference between the Democrats and the Republicans in Congress than for any Congress for which we have data. And we have a lot of data. So this makes it very, very difficult to reach across the aisle or to reach across the hypothetical aisle, metaphorical aisle in the public, because there's so many people who have such strong views, and they may be entirely wrong, but that doesn't matter. They have strong views, and they really, really dislike the president. Now, my own personal view is that those views are inappropriate, but nevertheless, that doesn't matter. They really, really dislike the president. It's very difficult then to persuade people to move from one side to the other side when they start out with the premise that this guy is a dangerous radical and needs to go. In fact, a majority of Republicans in one recent poll said that they thought that Barack Obama should be impeached.
So, but let me ask you then, because in reading your work, George, the one bottom line, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me you're kind of saying that presidents need to lead where the public wants to go, and then they'll be successful. Now, if you've got a deeply, deeply divided public, what does that say about the power of the presidency in general now?
Well, that's a real limit on the power of the presidency. We have very great expectations that presidents will come in and solve problems. And, of course, presidents encourage those in the campaign trail. And they say that if you elect me, things will be better, and I'll do this and I'll do that. But the fact is, if the public doesn't deal them a good hand, meaning if it doesn't give them the votes in Congress, there's very little chance that presidents are going to be able to bring about major changes. That's the nature of our system. We all know we have a separation of power system, which is actually really a system of sharing powers, and we don't have a parliamentary system, but we now have parliamentary style parties where everyone in one party opposes everyone in the other party reliably. And if you don't have a majority in Congress, then it's very difficult to get anything done.
Let's go to Edmund in Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, Edmund. Thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
It's very interesting what your guests have said recently, this gentleman that just finished talking. I'm 76 years old, and I lived through the equal rights problems in this country and how that turned out in a great, great success. But I have a feeling that if one were to scratch the surface of a lot of these politicians in Washington, you'll find a bigot. Nobody's had the guts to say that, but that's what it appears to me. I mean, I was born in New York City, and I'm a Yankee. But I must say, it seems very clear to me that when the minority leader of the House stands up and says, while the country is falling apart at the seams, I want a one-term president, and everybody goes bananas. I do believe that that's what you'll find if you scratch the surface of these people.
But maybe, Edmund, maybe they just don't like his policies.
Well, that might be true, but it seems awfully odd to me that the man hasn't been able to do a single solitary thing without being stonewalled. And that's not just political, I'm afraid.
Edmund, we've got it. I mean, you've got to say he certainly has done some things. He's got a big health care initiative that's coming online later this year and more. But there has been a lot of rugged going as well. Let me get Joanne in here from Sutton, New Hampshire. Edmund, thank you. Joanne, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
It's Joanna.
Sorry.
But I actually agree with just the previous caller. I mean, listen, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to see that the Republican Congress is just a bunch of disgruntled children still mad about the last two elections. And their main goal is to stonewall anything and everything positive that the president wants to do for our country. The president does have support of the from the public. I hear it all around me up here in New Hampshire. And Congress is just making fools of themselves by just not agreeing. I mean, President Obama could offer free lollipops to everybody, and they would still find some reason to, you know, to not agree. You know, it's just beyond ridiculous at this point. And for your guest speaker, George,
yes,
just for the record, Obamacare, the opposition to Obamacare said a lot of mistruths about that program. And you think that the public isn't behind it? Well, the reason is that you're hearing more mistruths about it than truths. And that's a big problem. Okay, sorry, I was getting very emotional about this.
Joanna, we've got it. Lots of people have access to the microphones these days, and there's no question about that. I mean, I'm wondering about where we go now, and I want to come to all three of you. And Jack, let me start with you, maybe. Look at this president. That was an odd press conference to have on the 100th day of your second term. That's still early days in the second term. There are expectations among his supporters of accomplishment. There's opposition that's very strong as well. What do you think, Jack? If you were there in the Oval Office, you know, giving your 2 cents to Barack Obama over that beer that Mitch McConnell's not drinking, what would you tell him?
Well, I think his best prospect really is immigration reform. That would be a major achievement. President Bush couldn't get it, tried hard. But here's the problem. As George said, he can't identify it as his policy. He's got to stand back and let Congress do it, because to the degree to which it has his name, it makes it toxic for Republicans. I mean, polls show that. If you ask voters, Republican voters, are you in favor of the various elements of immigration reform? They say yes. If you say, but Obama wants it, they say no.
Even when Marco Rubio was out there pushing for it, too?
But it's got to be all about Marco Rubio. It can't be about the president, and I think he knows that. And, you know, this has happened before. Harry Truman, when he was at his weakest in 1947 and 48, he got through the biggest foreign policy departure of a century, the Marshall Plan. How? He basically looked to the Republicans in Congress and Arthur Vandenberg and said, you do it. And they did it. And one of the reasons they did it is they thought they were going to beat him in 1948 and that they weren't giving him anything.
Beverly, do you see immigration as a high likelihood or strong prospect for this president? Is this one of the deals where there is a crisis of so many undocumented residents in this country where there may be Republican support for it as well? Does that make it a good shot for President Obama?
It seems like it's the kind of issue that might work in this environment, in part because you actually also have not only the kind of movement constituency, but you have a pretty serious business constituency that wants to see something done about this. And so you have constituencies that really cross both parts of the party there. You know, I think the things that Obama can do right now, even beyond particular legislation, is hope that the Democrats retake Congress in 2014, and work toward that, and we'll see what really happens there. But I think, as importantly, for the long term, if there are these moments of crisis or legislative dominance, when these opportunities come, you have to be ready for the opportunities. And so when you're in a position like he's in right now, one of the things that he really can be doing is making plans for him, for his successors, for other Democrats, for people who support the kinds of policies that he has, so that when those opportunities really are there, they can be taken advantage of.
George Edwards, put yourself in the Oval Office. Look at the horizon of issues here and this president, his temperament, his approach. How would you advise him for this second term?
Well, I think he does have to try to exploit the opportunity on immigration. In addition to what Beverly said, the fact is that the Republicans have a self-interest in passing something and making some progress.
To get over that demographic hump, to warm up that Latino electorate.
Exactly, because old white guys like me, you know, are not the future, and Latinos are.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got an incentive to do something. It's the same kind of incentive that they had with, if you remember, the fiscal cliff just a few months ago, when the fallback position, the default position, was an increase in taxes on everyone. So that wasn't acceptable to them. So Obama got something of what he wanted. There's not very many policies like that if you are a liberal Democratic president facing a conservative Republican House of Representatives. Usually the fallback position is of doing nothing is more acceptable to them than any change.
And what about the gun front? You know, go back to those Democrats. If he could just have had a handful of Democrats come over to his side, he would have had it. You know, is there a two-fisted sort of back room, you know, squeeze them hard where it hurts approach he could have taken there, or something else? Not.
I don't think so. There were four Democrats, so he would have had to get a couple of Republicans as well, because he had to have the 60.
Yeah.
It's quite interesting that although we have the 90% figure, We also, the Pew Research Center does very good polls, released a poll earlier this week. And they asked people, are you upset, angry, or relieved, or happy about what happened regarding the background checks? And it turns out that, of course, a big majority of Republicans were happy or relieved. And actually, a plurality of independents were. So that tells us quite a lot about the potential for gun control. There just isn't the kind of intense support for it that he needs to overcome the obstacles of a Republican House of Representatives and, of course, the organized interests on behalf of guns.
So are we a leadable nation, George, at this moment in our still young history?
Not in the way that we traditionally think of leadership, something like when I was taught as a platoon leader or a budding platoon leader many decades ago, and that is you get out in front and yell, follow me. And if you're a good leader, you have the right characteristics, the right skill, whatever, then people will follow you even in the face of enemy fire. And that just isn't a realistic view of how leadership actually works in the American political system.
Jack, it sounds like this is pool where you've got to do some bank shots, where you've got to bring a lot of algebra and calculus and geometry to bear.
Yes, and Harry Truman spoke of that when he talked about President Eisenhower taking over. He said, he'll sit here and he'll say, do this, do that, and nothing will happen. Poor Ike, it won't be a bit like the Army. He'll be very frustrated.
Presidents learn of what they speak, know of what they speak after a little while. Barack Obama may have been dealt a tougher hand than others here, but 100 days in, what an interesting moment. He's still got time to turn that around one direction or another, one way or another. We're very grateful to the three of you for being with us today. Beverly Gage at Yale University. Thank you, Beverly, Professor Gage, for being with us. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tom.
George Edwards at Texas A&M at Oxford. Professor Edwards, thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
And Jack, always great to have you, sir.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.